Early voting for the 2020 general election has begun in Iowa. As Iowans cast the first ballots of this election, we're going to talk about how going to the polls has changed through Iowa history. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Ballots, or tickets, presented to Iowa voters in the 19th century bear little resemblance to the ballots we fill out today. This hour, historian Leo Landis of the State Historical Museum of Iowa will tell us how ballots have evolved and share some of the forgotten stories of elections past. Later in the hour, many ambitious young Iowans head to the coasts to seek fame and fortune. We'll meet a former New York filmmaker who moved to Iowa. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation iCORE training program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll meet a filmmaker who moved from New York City to Iowa and found greater opportunity here. But first, Iowans are going to the polls. Early voting for the 2020 general election began today. Now, of course, we won't know the results of the Iowa vote until sometime after Election Day, November 3rd. But while we wait to learn what lies ahead, we're going to take a look back at voting in Iowa through history. With me this hour is historian Leo Landis. He is curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Hello, Leo.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And Leo, as we're about to learn, not surprisingly, voting has changed dramatically over more than a century of history that we're going to cover today. But I think that as we celebrate the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, I think it's important to start with the conversation that who can vote has changed even more dramatically, possibly, than the process.
It certainly has. And of course, our Constitution in Iowa, as we became a state in 1846, only provided that white males over the age of 21 could vote. That was expanded in 1868 to be the word white was struck. And then, as you alluded to, in 1920, though there had been efforts, and we've talked about this, and we've got a good Iowa 101 program with the State Historical Society, 1916, women almost had the right to vote in Iowa. It was voted down by Iowa men, but 1920, as you said, women then have the ability to vote in presidential and candidate elections in Iowa.
Well, and of course, people are filling out ballots now in a lot of different ways. Early in-person voting began today. Of course, absentee ballots also get mailed out today, and we'll have people going to the polls in Iowa on Election Day as well. So let's go way back in time to talk about how people used to vote, and they didn't even use ballots. They used something called tickets. Tell me what tickets were.
And that's why we use that term still today for each party's nominees. But men really did have to go to their party officials and get the slip of paper. So casting a vote up till 1892 in Iowa really was not a secret process for Iowa men. You had the slip of paper. We have some examples at the State Historical Museum. You know, the Lincoln-Hamlin ticket of 1860 shows Lincoln the rail splitter on the top. And those are the only candidates on the ticket are the Republican candidates. The same would be true for Democrats or any other ticket. So up till 1892, you went to your party. You almost always, the men voting were voting a straight party ticket, though you could cross out a name on it and maybe write in the opposing party's candidate or somebody you preferred more. But it was not a secret process in most states until the 1890s.
And who was responsible for counting those votes? If it wasn't a secret process, how was the security around counting?
Yeah, it was the local auditor and the local election officials who were in charge. So there was a ballot box. Machine voting comes in the early 1900s, but paper ballots even into today, if you're voting absentee, are common. So It was still the local election official, the county election officials who certified vote totals in the precincts. Though, you know, in cities like Waterloo, a big town in 1900, there might only be, you know, four, or in Des Moines, I think there were seven wards, is how county or the community would be divided up. And so you might have just one polling place in a town like Waterloo in 19, or have four polling places in Waterloo in 1900.
Wow. And you can, of course, think about all kinds of problems with this. I mean, obviously, no secrecy with who you're voting for leads to all kinds of personal and peer community pressure on individuals. But also, you know, of course, we hear about stuffing the ballot box, things like that. It's probably was a lot easier to break the rules.
It might have been, though. There was the process in place, at least I know by the early 1900s, where there was the voter registration, and not even early 1900s, I mean, into the late 1800s. You did have to register, and again, it's only men, so I say you, but men had to register. You presented yourself actually before election day on a specific day, and in many cases, to the local registrar and said, yes, I'm, you know, Leo Landis, and I am registered to vote, and I do intend to vote. So that was the kind of, you know, in the pre-ID days and pre-voter registration card days, you signed up with the registrar and then had to present yourself about a week out on any a specific given day in order to be certified to vote in the upcoming election.
All right, you had to really put in some effort.
There was. And again, our state, you know, we're not perfect, but we tend to have honest, I think, people. And so while there may have been in some elections an opportunity for fraud, our state has not had any, you know, great instance of voter fraud in our state. So that's encouraging about Iowa elections and Iowa officials.
So in your collection, you mentioned that you have some of these old tickets. You actually have a ticket that dates all the way back to 1836.
That's correct. We have a Democratic ticket that came out of the state of Virginia, but one reason why we would have something like that in our collection is because Martin Van Buren is the president. He wins that election following on Andrew Jackson's success as a Democrat, and he's president when the Iowa Territory is founded on July 4th, 1838. So it makes sense for us to have an 1836 Democratic ticket in our collection.
Well, and you also have some tickets from 1860. I'm curious, if the tickets were passed on in this way and wind up in a historical collection, does that mean that they weren't cast?
Exactly right. I don't see on the examples that we have, and we have three examples of Republican tickets from maybe four from 1860, and they're different colors sometimes. So we have a pinkish one, a blue one, and a white one, all from Republican ticket vote of 1860. We've got them up to 1888 in the collection, and as I mentioned, 1892 is when Iowa has its first official ballot.
Why were they printed on different colored paper?
You know, it was locally a way to, you know, say, oh, I'm going to grab the Republican ticket. It may have been just a way to set them apart from, you know, if the Democrats were printing on white, to say, oh, we've got a colored ticket. Again, having icons on the tickets, too, were very common, whether it be an American Eagle using words like union, especially for Republicans after the Civil War, as the party who supported the Union. So having colors and terms and also images to reflect your party. Democrats often, before the donkey was used, sometimes used a rooster as their symbol. So you'd see symbols like that. So if your literacy was a little lower, a person could say, hey, just look for the image that's on there, and that'll be the party you want to make sure you vote for.
Oh, fascinating. And now, I don't know why anybody would want to do this, but would there have been anything to prevent you from going and getting your Republican ticket and going and getting your Democratic ticket or another party ticket?
You certainly could have done that, but especially in Iowa, because of its support for the Union through the Civil War, really tends strongly to be Republican. So you generally didn't want to be a Republican seen going to a Democratic official to have a Democratic ticket in your possession. So that would have been pretty unusual. And we're grateful. We don't know exactly where ours came from, but Charles Aldrich, who was the first director of the historical department, he was active in collecting documents pre-1900. The historical department was founded in the 1890s, and so he had been active across the state prior to that. So it wouldn't surprise me if our tickets came from Charles Aldrich.
I want to get to the phones here. David has a question in Iowa City. Hello, David.
Hello. I'd like to know, before the telegraph, when things were going around by horse in a lot of areas, how long after the polls closed would a state know who won? And how long would the nation take to know how many states were won by a particular candidate, because it couldn't have been the same night? And I'll take your answer off
the
air.
That's a great question. Thank you, David. Leo?
Well, you know, the telegraph, at least in our state, is developed in the 1830s, 1840s. It's perfected. So at least in Iowa, you knew pretty soon how soon, who had won the election. Though, again, things are done locally, so prior to the perfection of the telegraph, you still have local communication, and it would be within a few days to know for sure who had taken a state, and then communication nationally was able to send letters by postal service from stages that moved fairly fast, and steamships, and even railroads as they're developing in the 1820s and 1830s. So you get communication that gives you a good idea by within the first week of the election who is going to be the winner.
All right. Well, that feels like a very, very relevant question this year, when we will probably be waiting longer than we're used to get some general election results. You mentioned the voting machines. So again, when did the voting machine? Well, first, let's start with the ballot. When did the ballot first appear?
Sure. Massachusetts and some of the eastern states are the first to adopt a secret ballot. It often gets called the Australian ballot, since it was style that came out of Australia. And so if you're doing research on the development of a secret ballot in the United States, you look for Australian ballot, or you can look for secret ballot. And 1892 is the first election that Iowa has a ballot with every party on it. Before that, it was up to the individual parties. And so it was up to the county to create its own ticket. So that way, if they're its own ballot, I should say, got to watch out for those terms, its own ballot. And then if there were local elections, there might even be a separate ballot connected to either a local issue or a constitutional amendment issue for the state. So 1892 for Iowan men is when they have a secret ballot, and can even, there was straight party ticketing even then. There's an Iowan on that ballot for the Progressive Party, General James B. Weaver.
All right, we'll talk more about that in just a moment. We are going to take a short break. With me today, historian Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. We're talking about how voting has changed through many decades in our state. You're welcome to call with your questions, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are taking a look back at voting through the generations in Iowa. With me, historian Leo Landis. He is curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. And you're welcome to join in the conversation with your questions or your comments, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Leo, just before the break, you mentioned James B. Weaver of Bloomfield. So now, we famously, here in Iowa, we have one president, Herbert Hoover, who hailed from Iowa, one vice president, Henry Wallace, who hailed from Iowa, but that doesn't mean we haven't had a whole lot of presidential and vice presidential hopefuls over the years. So tell me a little bit more about James B. Weaver. He was the first Iowan to appear on a presidential ballot?
That's correct. And he had been a Republican. He had served in the Civil War and was really a popular and populist in the sense of he tried to support issues connected to workers and also farmers. And that was his base of strength. And as he felt the Republican Party was paying less attention to those groups in the post-Civil War in the 1870s, 1880s, he joins the Greenback Party. He actually served in the, and they supported the printing of money. That's why they're called the Greenback Party, just like we're using dollar bills and green printed paper. That was not the case except in the Civil War. And so he joins that Greenback Party, serves in the U.S. House for the Greenback Party, and then is the 1880 nominee. So we don't have a presidential ticket. We do have a Greenback ticket, I think, from 1882 in our collection. But he's the 1880 nominee on the Greenback Party. And so he does get some votes. Then in 1892, that election we were referencing, he actually gets more than 20 electoral votes. So he actually is the first Iowan to receive support in the Electoral College as a presidential candidate.
Wow. Well, and let's go back to how we vote, because you mentioned that the voting machine came about in the early part of the 20th century. Tell me about that transition.
Sure. And it is some of the predecessors of the machines that we have today, but it was a lever system, and I know a lot of listeners are still familiar with that. The party, Iowa has had an on-again, off-again straight party ticket support. Right now you cannot vote a straight party ticket, but in those early days you could, and so you could pull a single lever down for your party, just a lever about 2 inches long, if even that, and you pulled it down, and that would select an entire party, or you could go through, depending on how many candidates there were, and move a lever for each candidate. And then when you did that behind a curtain in a privacy booth with the machine, then when you opened the curtain, that registered your vote. And those early machines, our earliest one is from Johnson County, believed to be one of the earliest, if not the first, used in Johnson County, I think in 1904. So, using machines by the early 1900s was pretty typical.
Well, and from the way that you describe that, I only got to use a similar sounding machine once in my own voting history, and then we moved to the scanning technology that we have now. But it sounds like those machines stayed really pretty much the same throughout the 20th century.
They certainly did. And part of the argument, again, going back to the secret ballot, was that it did eliminate the opportunity for mischief, and so this was the scientific way to vote and would protect the integrity of the election by having a machine do that. And of course, we know that there are always debates about that, too.
I honestly have such fond memories of the one time that I got to use a voting machine because of the nice clicks and the clunk noise. It felt very satisfying to vote that way. Although in thinking about voting that straight party ticket and that it was a secret ballot, if somebody went in and voted a straight party ticket, it took so much less time than to vote on each category. I would think everybody in the room would know what you did.
That could be, but again, there might only be the poll workers plus another four or five voters in the room at the same time. There might be people in line, though. Again, in Iowa, we typically have well-run elections, so we don't generally have long lines, though there have been concerns about that at times. And so people might know how you were voting, but that was not a big concern.
All right. Well, speaking of long lines, you do have, and that's something that we get worried about during election season. And again, it's something that has come up a huge worry during this election season all over the country. You have an example dating back 120 years with a very similar conversation.
That's exactly right. As I was researching this topic, and we do a caucus exhibit every 4 years at the State Historical Museum for obvious reasons, and just also looking at elections, too, for presidency. Waterloo, as I referenced earlier, had only four wards for voting. And again, it's men, but it's a large town. And so some of the local leaders had done research saying, hey, there's 1,000 voters in Ward 3 and nearly 1,000 voters in Ward 4 or vice versa. And in order for us to have, all those voters show, all those men show up and vote in the time the polls are open, that's going to create a log jam. And the idea then was to encourage people through the newspaper to go and to encourage the men to go and vote early. And so that's a message I think we all endorse, is try to get your voting done if you're voting on election day or by a absentee ballot. Get it done as soon as you can.
Well, I drove past a line for voting on my way here today. So some people have certainly taken that message to heart. Now, we mentioned Herbert Hoover and Henry Wallace. And we also talked about James B. Weaver, the first Iowan to appear on a presidential ticket. Let's talk about some of the other unusual firsts. Let's talk about women on the ballot.
Sure. Women as presidential candidates. This year's fun because we have two Iowa women on the ballot this year for the genealogy Know Your History Party. So this is the first time two Iowa women have been on the ballot together. Women have been on the ballot together as early as 1972 in Iowa, but they weren't Iowa women. So candidate Ricky King went through the process, and she is listed as the presidential candidate, and she has a colleague who's the vice presidential candidate. So this is the first time we've had two Iowa women on a ballot. But again, going back to 1972, perhaps earlier, we know that two women have been nominees of parties.
Well, and that's also a great reminder that although we do tend to have a two-party system in the United States, that there are more than two parties. We've also seen through history the Republican and Democratic Party, you know, the two main parties, morph so much that they've almost switched places in some ways, which must make it interesting to really explore this history.
It has been fun, and that's one of the stories that we can talk about, too, is a candidate who is an Iowan, and he doesn't actually make it onto the ballot, but he does get some support in other states, and I haven't seen any returns from Iowa, but George Taylor, who lived in Oskaloosa and then later in Ottumwa, he's an African-American, he starts supporting the Republican Party, as so many blacks did through the 1920s. And then he is part of a group in 1892 that goes to the Republican Party and says, hey, we need an anti-lynching law. And he's actually a delegate from Iowa to the Republican National Convention. I believe it was held in Minneapolis that year. And he feels like the Republican Party has betrayed the legacy of Lincoln when it doesn't support that anti-lynching law. And so in 1896, he then is a Democrat. And so even some of the debates and some of the characterizations of the parties today go back to the sentiments of people 130 years ago or 125 years ago.
Well, and let's just underline this. I mean, even if he wasn't on the ballot in Iowa, the fact that a black man from Iowa was getting national attention in 1904 as a candidate, that seems like a really remarkable moment.
It really is a compelling story. He had been born in Arkansas. His mother was not enslaved. She was a free woman. Arkansas passed a law expelling all free blacks from the state in the late 1850s. So they moved to Illinois for a short time. Then he was adopted when his mother died. His father had been enslaved, so his father did not join them when they left Arkansas. And he then comes to Iowa in 1891. And when he becomes disappointed in both parties, as you said, he runs and gets the nomination from the National Negro Liberty Party, sometimes just called the National Liberty Party, in 1904. And so he is nationally seen as a viable candidate. And one of the challenges candidates still face today is getting onto various states' ballots. And so he wasn't able to get onto the Iowa ballot, not meeting the requirements at the time in 1904. But he really was out there promoting issues of social equity and anti-lynching and justice for African Americans, and saying, you know, we are the equal to anyone. Blacks deserve equality, and we need to take it upon ourselves. And so he was a significant figure. He stays in Iowa for about 20 years, from 1891 to 1910, and then moves to Florida. And so the story of George Taylor, some people know it, but it's one Iowans should be aware.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people do think that Representative Shirley Chisholm was the first black candidate to run for president in the United States. That was in 1972. And her history is well worth noting and knowing. But this was so long before that, 1904. That's really remarkable.
Exactly right. And Taylor's story is one that we know of at the State Historical Museum. Other museums across the state know it. And part of that was there was such a strong black population in southeast Iowa and south central Iowa connected to mining that he had a lot of support. He published a newspaper for blacks in Iowa called the Negro Solicitor when he was in Oskaloosa, and then becomes prominent. As we said, nationally, he goes to the Republican National Convention and is part of a group that really is advocating for black equality and complaining about lynching in the South, but also the unfair treatment of blacks across the country.
We are talking about voting through Iowa history right now. With me, Leo Landis. He is curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Alan is on the line in Davenport. Hi, Alan.
Hello. I have a question about the write-in candidates. It seems like I remember using the old voting machines with the levers. And could one arrive in the morning and just, like, write in a name and thus other people select the candidate for, like, a mayor where they work on local elections?
So you're asking if somebody could change the ballot by writing something in?
Yes. Write-in candidates, you could actually write a little slip of paper underneath the lever where you could write a name. When the current system is, if you're a write-in candidate, nobody knows about you unless you know about them.
Right. That's a really good comment, and that's one I haven't looked at. But did you have to request then a separate? And I'm sure, you know, there are people who are long-time serving poll workers who can say, "Oh, here's how you did that in the machine era. If you wanted to write someone in, would you request a paper ballot at the polling place?" And I'm guessing that's how that did happen, and so that you could vote and then submit a paper ballot if you wanted to write in a name during the machine voting. And just to go back to the earlier caller, Charity, as we were on the break a few minutes ago, I looked. Within a week, people across the country knew that Andrew Jackson had been elected president in 1828. So usually within a week, people knew.
Wow, that seems really remarkable. Especially we've lived through some longer tallying than that, all of
us. If you were around in 2000 anyway, that's
yep.
Right.
All right. So we only have a few minutes left here, Leo. In looking at the history of our voting, what strikes you, not just as a historian, but as a citizen in 2020?
Well, I commend Iowans, and we're usually in the top 10 of voter participation. So get out there, register to vote. You've got time till I think October 23rd or 24th this year to register and participate. It's the way that one of the few ways that we get to control the future of our nation. So Iowans are very civic minded. Your vote does matter, and the Secretary of State's office and the auditors are going to be glad to help you in navigating that process. And so I think Iowans, you know, we're behind Minnesota and I think Wisconsin. So let's see if we can get ahead of them this year, too, and have bigger voter participation. That's what I would encourage Iowans, is to take advantage of that, Charity.
Well, and it sounds like just even through history, even way back when we had those party tickets where you had to vote straight party or you know, really alter it yourself, it sounds like Iowans took voting very seriously, almost as a sacred right.
Exactly. And because so many men had served in the Civil War and had women and men had contributed to the war effort, and then through Spanish-American War, World War One, on the heels of World War One, there was really activity in you know, training voters how to go through that process. So newspapers have long printed the ballots so people can study beforehand and make informed decisions in the voting process. And so I know that's common across the country, but I think Iowans really have valued the ability to vote. And part of that, I think, you know, we didn't give women the opportunity to vote, even though they had that right. They didn't have it legally until 1920. And so I think that in people's memory, if you had a mother or a grandmother who remembered voting for the first time, that's something that voting is important for Iowans, and being engaged civically is important.
In researching the old ballots and ways of voting, do you think there's anything we've lost in how we're doing elections today?
You know, I don't think we're any more or less partisan so much than we always have been, to a degree partisan. I think that, you know, we may not be as open to some of the communication, and that, you know, with media and sound bites, there aren't necessarily the opportunities to hear candidates really put forward ideas in a concrete way, or it's on the internet, and so you don't get that as a social experience as much as you might have in a pre-internet, pre-mass media day. And so, you know, we still have rallies and things today, but you'll often see, you know, rallies listed for candidates, even though, you know, Lincoln wasn't traveling to Iowa. We've got a great banner from a group. They were called the Wide Awakes across the country, the Wide Awakes, who were marching in Washington, Iowa, supporting the candidacy of Lincoln in 1860. So those kind of, you know, spontaneous organized rallies still happen, but I think there was a more opportunity for that in the past.
And especially not during a pandemic.
Exactly.
So, Leo Landis, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's always my pleasure, Charity.
Historian Leo Landis, he is curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many ambitious young people in Iowa are eager to leave the state as soon as they can. They head for big cities in search of opportunity, maybe even fame and fortune. My next guest did the opposite. Graham Swan was living in New York City and working as a film producer. He and his wife decided to move to her home state of Iowa, and much to his surprise, he found the kind of opportunity he was dreaming of in NYC. He is on the line with me now. Hello, Graham.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here, and welcome to Iowa.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So let's go back in time. I know that you dreamed of being a filmmaker even as a child. Where did you grow up?
Mm-hmm. I traveled around a lot as a kid, but I grew up mostly on the East Coast in New Jersey, suburban New Jersey, you know, about an hour and a half out of New York City.
And what was it that drew you to film?
I don't know exactly. I think, you know, you just feel an affinity for something when you see it. I watched a lot of films as a kid. I remember especially watching Turner Classic Movies with my dad every October, which I still do this every October, which was they would have a marathon of the Universal horror films, you know, from the 1930s and 40s. And I was always really taken with those from a young age. And it was really when I was around 12, I saw a community theater production. And I hadn't ever really thought about theater or understood how these things were made. And somebody I knew was in the production. And when I realized it was something you could do, that you could be part of, I really changed all my focus to film and theater at that point, and have done so since.
So what drew you to New York City?
Well, I think, you know, when I was I went to university for theater direction in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon. And, you know, when you're graduating from university, especially in the arts, I think there's a strong pull to go to one of the major cities, especially if you're looking to work in film or theater. You know, it's very heavily New York and Los Angeles, because there's a perception of that's where the jobs are, that's where the opportunities are, and that's how you'll, you know, build a career. So I went to New York. I had family there, and I had some connections there, and I thought, you know, this is the place to go to do this kind of work. So that was what brought me to the city initially, was to get closer to film, to be able to see more films, go to festivals and have a bigger connection to those things.
And tell me a little bit about what it's like to work your way up in the film world in New York City. It's a very, very competitive field.
Yeah, it's an extremely competitive field. There's anywhere in the arts, and I think, you know, this is especially true of film, there's such a greater quantity of people who want to be involved than the industry, such as it is, really can support. So I think, you know, a lot of people end up going and spending a lot of time working on things they don't really care about, or maybe are not that connected to why they were interested in the field in the first place. That was something I had really wanted to avoid when I went to New York. I kind of had this vision that if I tried to go into production, I would end up working on a lot of advertisements or, you know, reality TV shows or something like that, because that would be where the jobs were. And I, for numerous reasons, was kind of cognizant of the world of film distribution, really putting films into theaters. So, and I thought, you know, there's a lot fewer people trying to do that work because it's not something they teach you about in school, and it's not something that's, you know, sexy or related to any of the kind of slightly mythic qualities of filmmaking, you know, celebrities and things like that. So I started working my way up first as an intern in some offices, and then fairly quickly working in film distribution on mostly foreign documentary and independent films, which is the kind of film that I care about. So I was able to find a way that I could pay my rent and still get closer and have a part in, putting out films that I cared about.
So in talking about this with the community of filmmakers that you were a part of in New York City, what kinds of things did you talk about as far as the challenges of being in that field and trying to do what you were trying to do?
The biggest challenge always with filmmaking is financial. Films are remarkably expensive to make, even small independent films or what people call micro-budget films. You know, a micro-budget film could easily cost $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, and people think that's nothing in the field. You know, a $2 million film is considered very low budget. So that's the biggest difficulty, especially when you're starting and even after working in it for some years, is how do you find the resources necessary to put the vision that you care about on screen? And I think also something I've always been really troubled with is how can you do that in an ethical way? To spend so much on a piece of art can feel futile, but over time you find ways to do it in a way that's responsible and ethical and allows you to move forward and hopefully put something of value into the world.
So our quality of life in Iowa is something that we often talk about here in the state as an open secret. And of course, I know that we have our challenges and our problems. It's not a utopia. But tell me how you discovered that maybe living in Iowa as a filmmaker might actually be a better option. First of all, your wife is from here, right?
Yeah, my wife is from Fairfield, and I had been to Iowa numerous times, mostly Southeast Iowa, Iowa City area and Fairfield area numerous times on, you know, vacations and family trips, holidays, that kind of thing. And I always really loved it here. I always felt there was this real sense of space and a kind of peacefulness that I like. But I think, you know, we had been in New York for about 10 years, and both of us, my wife is a visual artist, and both of us were working on our own work as well as working, you know, jobs, 5-6 day a week office jobs related to our fields, but not what we wanted to be doing ultimately. And we kind of came to the realization that we would be doing that potentially forever. For another 20, 30, 40 years, you'd be having to have this spend 50 hours a week on this one job and 20 hours a week on your own work and be exhausted. And so we had decided that we wanted to get out of the city because we felt we were at a place where the time was more valuable than the access to cultural institutions or, social interactions that I think are what really draw people to a big city like New York. Iowa hadn't been the first place we thought. We had looked upstate New York, we had looked other places, and we were always kind of running into this wall that it was going to cost us just as much to live in a house in that kind of place as it was costing us to live in an apartment in Brooklyn. And then, a house that was in her family kind of came up and was going to go on the market in Fairfield. And we thought about it and looked at it and realized we could live in a house with, you know, several acres of land in a beautiful place with a fantastic community, and it would cost us so much less that we would actually be able to focus our time on our work instead of getting sucked back into this kind of capitalistic rat race that you get put in where you're just paying to survive.
So tell me a little bit about adjusting to life in Iowa. Once you made that decision to move here, what was that like?
You know, it's been interesting because I was very nervous about it at first. You know, right up until we were in the moving truck driving out here, I was feeling a lot of anxiety. Was this a mistake? Was I going to feel disconnected? And, you know, I ultimately was traveling a lot, which made the transition easier. You know, I would go back to New York for a month for some work. I would go to Los Angeles for some work. And I was traveling a lot, and I really felt grounded. And any time I was back at our home here in Fairfield, that it was like, okay, here's my space and my work, and I can think. You know, it's been interesting with the pandemic because I haven't left the state since March, well, other than very briefly in a car. And I just feel at home. I don't know. There's not another way to put it. There's a feeling that you can be yourself and do your work and think and breathe here in a way that I never felt in New York.
Well, and you find a lot of inspiration in the space that we have in Iowa. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So the film that I'm working on now that I recently received this Greenlight grant from the Iowa Arts Council for was something that I started writing before we moved because I wanted to work on an idea that I could produce in the space we'd be living in. And especially, I think that, you know, certain places in New York and LA particularly, but also several other big cities like Chicago, they're very photographed. You know, there's a million movies that take place in New York. You've seen those streets a million times. And one of the challenges when you're working there is how can you look at this space in a different way? How can you not just recycle these images that you've seen your whole life? And so I was really interested in saying, okay, there's very comparatively few films shot in the rural Midwest, and I wanted to think about a project that would function in that way so I could also spend more time researching and being in the space and looking for the images that would work. So I started working on a project that we're going to be shooting here next spring. Location is everything, sometimes they say, and it's true. You know, you get so much from a place, and there's so many unique things to see in any space. I think the biggest thing for me being here has been this renewed connection with the natural world of being able to watch, not just to see the stars, but to watch a moon rise, which is something I probably hadn't seen, even in my childhood in the suburbs in New Jersey. You didn't really see the moon rise because there was still too much light pollution. And here where I am, you know, I'm off a little dirt road. And when the moon comes up, it's transformative. The entire space changes. So getting to exist in that environment and see the way the seasons and the light change the space has been really hugely impactful for me.
Let's talk more about this grant you received for the project. As I mentioned, I mean, you moved to Iowa and in many ways found the kind of opportunity you'd been dreaming about in New York City. And I've talked in the past with Produce Iowa about the Greenlight grants. But tell me about what you applied for and what it's going to allow you to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So the grant, it's called the Greenlight Grant. They do them annually, and it's through the Iowa Arts Council and Produce Iowa. And it's a grant for, it can be for documentaries or narrative projects, but it's a grant where essentially it's a matching grant where they will give you a certain portion of your budget to match another portion that you've raised for productions that will take place primarily in Iowa with an Iowa, you know, creative team. And it's something that's really rare in this country. I'm sure, as you know, working for an NPR affiliate, that the arts and culture are very marginally funded in the United States. So to find things that allow you to make art that can give you the resources you need to do something like make a film, they're really rare, and they're really, really competitive. So there's a very small handful of these in New York. Most of them are nationally, and most of them are primarily for documentary films, which have a little bit more of a clear educational quality than narrative films do, and are maybe easier to raise these kind of institutional funds for. But when I first moved here, when I was actually going to move here, a friend of mine named Craig Webster, who is a filmmaker who lives in New York, who went to U of I in Iowa City, and he said, you know, there's really good arts funding in Iowa. You should look into their film funding. And, you know, when I searched and looked at the grant, I thought, wow, this is like exactly what I was looking for. You know, this was a project that was already put together. We already had a certain amount of the money. It was already intended to be made, to be shot in Iowa. And then it was like the perfect object in front of me. I've kind of developed a steel skin where you apply for something like a grant or a festival or whatever it is, you hit submit, and then I try to forget about it and assume that I didn't receive it, because it lessens it when you inevitably, face a lot of rejection going through these things. So then when I had seen it and it was perfect, I tried to keep my expectations low. And then when I received it, I just thought, everything's kind of aligning. I was meant to make this move to do this project in this place. And there was even a grant that was already set up for me to try to complete it. So it's been a really transformative part of the process, and I'm really excited to be able to start shooting here.
Yeah, well, and the film is called An Evening Song. Tell us about it. What's it about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a melodrama of sorts set in 1939. It's inspired, not exactly based on, but inspired certain events from the life and work of a writer named Barbara Newhall Follett, who was a child prodigy, who wrote a really incredible novel when she was 12 called The House Without Windows. For numerous reasons, she didn't write much else in her life, and she actually disappeared when she was in her late 20s. She was living in a rural area, and she left her house one day with $30, and nobody ever saw her again. And so it's this little literary mystery around her. And when I first heard that story, and I got kind of interested in who was this person, and it seemed to have a certain quality that could be dug into. And then when I read her novel, her most famous novel, The House Without Windows, I was so bowled over by the way she sees the world, and to see the world through an extremely articulate 12-year-old's eyes, because it's not a children's book at all. It's a very serious novel. And it gave me a lot of inspiration to try to tell the story of the couple weeks or months before this former writer, this former child prodigy writer, disappears, and the way the world and the natural world is forming around her and how she's interacting with it. It's a certain kind of romantic melodrama, but with a lot of connection to ideas of nature and thoughts about how landscapes and how the natural world changes around us and how we change in relation to it. So I think my principal concern or anxiety in the world is climate change and the massive changes that are already happening in our world, and how we as humans can or should attempt to look at or change ourselves or understand ourselves in relationship to a world that's changing so rapidly around us.
Well, and you mentioned that you had hoped to start filming this fall. That's been pushed to the mm-hmm. spring. I assume that's a pandemic
yes.
problem.
That's largely a pandemic problem. I originally wanted to shoot in October, in which case we'd be shooting, in the next couple of weeks. But when we were really starting and going into pre-production and doing all the research, I just concluded there was no reason to put any additional health risks on anybody to shoot this faster. And I'm actually really relishing the time to spend, extra months looking at locations, finding the right feel the right
woods,
the right houses.
Filming goes great this spring. And Graham, we're out of time, but best of luck to you. Thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much for talking to me. All right. See you on the sound.
Filmmaker Graham Swan. This is Talk of Iowa.